are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Well, William Shakespeare certainly didn't know about pulsars, but I rather think that he was giving the astronomers a real hint not to be too surprised at the exciting developments in the future. Because when pulsars burst upon the astronomical world in 1968, it was a real surprise, a type of object that had not been seen or listened to before. And it wasn't long before astronomers realized that they were neutron stars. And a neutron star is a thing that staggers the imagination. A little body only 10 miles or so in diameter, with a mass comparable with that of our sun. That means a density running to a million million times that of water. A cubic inch of the material would weigh a billion tons here on Earth. And my guest today will talk about the pulsars and the dying stars and exploding stars. They are Dr. Philip Kronberg, a radio astronomer, assistant professor at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Sidney Vandenberg, professor of astronomy, also at the University of Toronto, who is an expert in the remnants of dying stars and has photographed one of the bursting stars with the largest optical telescope in the world, the 200-inch on Palomar Mountain. So let's begin with talking about what a pulsar is and how they were found. Philip, how do you define a pulsar?
Well, a pulsar is distinguished from any other source of radio noise that we receive from the cosmos, in that the radio emission comes to us in pulses or short bursts, and hence the name pulsar. The way in which these were discovered is quite remarkable because it was entirely an accident. Radio astronomers and astronomers in general are used to thinking in terms of very slowly varying signals, and most radio sources, for that matter, barely vary even over a time scale of thousands of years. So that you can see that astronomers with this sort of experience weren't actually looking for things that varied and sent pulses on the time scale of about 1 second or less.
Who found them? In England?
Yes, that's right. They were discovered by a graduate student at the University of Cambridge at the radio observatory there. And
a lady.
It was a lady, that's right. Miss Bell was her name.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working with Dr. Hewish at Cambridge in looking for variations from radio sources which were not intrinsic to the sources, but which were caused by the medium around the sun and in our galaxy through which the rays had to pass. So she was looking for variations, and this is a relatively new study. And it was in the course of this that pulsars were discovered.
And these have enormously short periods.
Yes, the shortest period pulsar, that is the most rapidly pulsing one, has a period of about 33 milliseconds, 33 thousandths of a second.
And that means it repeats very, very rapidly.
That's right, yes, and remarkably, with remarkable accuracy too. That is, the repetition rate of the pulses is remarkably constant over a long period of time.
I understand that this great regularity made the discoverers wonder if this was really a signal from intelligent life in space at first, the little green men, but they ruled it out.
Yes, well, that I think, given that astronomers didn't really expect such things, after all, astronomers are human, and it's perhaps not surprising that that thoughts would immediately turn to something, you know, some sort of civilization or some intelligent source for these things. And as I understand, it was actually considered seriously, not just by the press, but by the astronomers who were doing the experiments.
You have a tape of how these little beeps sound.
That's right. Yes, I have a tape which was recorded with the telescope at Jodrell Bank in England, the large 250-foot telescope. looking at a pulsar, and we'll listen to this tape. But before we have it on, I must warn you that pulsars are unpredictable in that the rapidly varying pulses, or the sequence of pulses, is often interrupted. Even one particular pulse can be missing for some reason we don't entirely understand. So that when you listen to the pulses, you'll find that they're erratic. They don't come every quarter of a second, if that's the period, but you miss some and they come back and so on. And also, you cannot tell when they're ahead of time when they're going to be strong. So as we listen to this, you'll notice a lot of hiss and noise, but interspersed, you ought to hear a few pulses which repeat at every quarter second interval. They tended to come in a series sequence of bursts.
Yes, you could hear the little peaks. Well, how did the idea of the neutron star, as the explanation, come in, Sidney?
Well, it turns out, if you look into the theory of stellar pulsations, that the denser an object is, the faster it will pulsate. And there were only two possibilities. Either these objects were white dwarfs, or they were neutron stars. Neutron stars are about a million times denser than white dwarfs, and it turned out that you really needed the neutron star density in order to get variations as fast as those that are observed in pulsars.
And a white dwarf is a little star that's a million times denser than our sun,
yes,
isn't it?
So a pulsar, a neutron star, has a density about a million times greater than the density of water.
You can put it down in figures, but can you actually visualize it?
Not really.
And what accounts for this remarkable periodicity?
The current idea is that neutron stars are objects that are spinning extremely rapidly, and just like our own Earth always rotates with the same period, in the same way a neutron star also keeps rotating at an almost fixed rate, and therefore the pulses come at regular intervals. Now, it turns out, if one observes these pulses very carefully, that in fact pulsars are slowing down very gradually. For instance, the best known pulsar, the one in the Crab Nebula, is doubling its, is halving its frequency of pulsation every 1,000 years or so. And, of course, since these objects are rotating so very fast, you do find that there is a tremendous amount of energy in the rotation, and if this thing slows down, then part of this rotational energy is lost. So the energy that we see in the pulses is ultimately derived from the energy of rotation.
I understand that the electrical energy from a quarter of a square inch of a pulsar surface is equivalent to the total electrical energy output of our Earth.
Yes.
Did you go along with that?
That's about correct, yes.
Well, now there are only a few observatories that have the specialized equipment at hand ready to actually working on pulsars now. Philip, is that correct?
Yes, that is true. And first I should explain that pulsars emit their pulses only over a relatively small range of radio wavelengths. So it's the telescopes which operate at certain wavelength bands which are used. This rules out certain other telescopes which are used.
What would roughly be the wavelength band?
It is from anywhere from about I would say about 10 meters, let's say, down to a wavelength of about 10 centimeters. Wavelengths shorter than 10 centimeters, pulsars fall off in intensity very rapidly, so you don't see them at these wavelengths. Now, so what you're really asking is what telescopes in the world collect lots of energy, are very sensitive at these longer wavelengths, because we tend to call wavelengths longer than 10 centimeters long these days. The largest collecting surface is probably the 1,000-foot Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico, which is a spherical surface carved into a valley, which has a diameter of 1,000 feet, and it looks at a very small range of sky, and then of course as the Earth rotates, the sky sweeps past the beam of the telescope, and it can look at different pulsars in sequence during the course of the day. Then there is the 250-foot telescope at Jodrell Bank, which is was the first of the large generation of large telescopes, and it has been used extensively for pulsars as well, and that's what we see a picture of.
Will the new big German telescope that's just going into operation be working on them?
Yes, the new telescope in Germany has now superseded the Jodrell Bank telescope as the largest steerable telescope in the world.
And how big is it?
It has a diameter of 100 meters. And it will
be... Over 300 feet.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. And it will be an extremely powerful instrument for looking at pulsars, particularly at the short wavelengths, because it's very efficient at short wavelengths.
You visited the installation some months back.
That's right. Yes, on my last visit, actually, the telescope was only under construction, and it is in quite a pretty setting, and the view, as you approach it, shows only the very top of the telescope, and when I was there, it was only the top of the construction crane, which you can see in the poking out of the valley. It's sitting in a very steep valley. The telescope moves on a circular track, and the next picture shows you the wheels and the supporting structure, which moves around on this track. And to get an appreciation of the size, you can spot a small minibus sitting beside the track, and it is really a huge and impressive instrument indeed.
And the specifications for this were amazingly precise, and I understand.
That's right. That's why it's able to look at pulsars at the short wavelengths, because it operates at very short wavelengths, which some of these other telescopes are not able to do.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Dutch astronomers? They have some equipment for this type?
That's right. The Dutch have just completed an array of 12 telescopes in an east-west line, which extends over 1 mile. And this is... a very powerful telescope indeed, and it's the first of its of a new generation of such instruments. Now it will be used a little bit for pulsars, but it tends to work at the shorter wavelengths, where, as I said, pulsars generally aren't observed very much. So it's a secondary instrument, you might say, as far as pulsars are concerned.
But actually, the equipment belonging to Cambridge that pulsars were first discovered with was not. On a very grand scale, is that correct?
Yes. If you observe at very long wavelengths, like let's say 10 meters wavelength, you can build an antenna which collects lots of radio signals just by laying wires across a field and connecting them up in a sensible fashion. And that is what the Cambridge telescope was meant to do, only of course it was meant, as I said, to look for variations due to the atmosphere of the sun in quasars, in fact. Now, this is probably one of the cheapest telescopes in terms of construction cost that you could imagine. It was a very simple telescope indeed, and it was built for this special purpose of looking for variations in other sources.
And pulsars can be represented in a graph by just little peaks in the signal that's received.
That's right. If you were to look at a pulse, the profile of a pulse, an individual pulse, one of the ones we heard on the audio recording, you would see something which is shown in this picture. And here we have six different profiles, each of a different pulsar. And one of the remarkable things is that each pulsar has its own characteristic profile. And of all the pulsars that we've studied so far, no two have an identical profile. So if you are a radio astronomer who studies pulsars, you can simply be shown the profile if you really know them very well, and you can tell which pulsar it is. It's like a signature.
There are about 50 pulsars known now?
Approximately 50 pulsars are known this far.
Well, now that we've heard something about what a pulsar is. Sydney, tell us how they come into being, these strange, dense creatures.
Well, stars lead a rather precarious existence. They are objects which are very delicately balanced between, on the one hand, the crushing forces of gravity, which try to compress a star, pull it together, and these forces are counteracted by pressures set up in the interiors of stars by the heat generated by nuclear reactions.
And the average star would have a diameter of, say, 1,000,000 miles.
Something like
our
sun. And a mass of perhaps 1,000,000 times the mass of the Earth. And all of this mass is trying to fall together, and the pressure in the center is trying to keep it up. Now, a star can go on balancing in this way as long as it has nuclear fuel. But the nuclear fuel supply in a star is limited. And after a while, a star has converted all of its nuclear energy. All hydrogen has been converted into helium.
And how long is this while?
And that depends on the mass of the star. The most luminous stars spend their energy very fast. They'll only last for a few million years. Fainter stars, like the Sun, will last for about 10,000 million years before they've used up all their nuclear energy. But once the nuclear energy is gone, there is nothing to prevent the star from collapsing. And what happens? Either one of three things can happen then. If you have a star of relatively low mass, it will collapse quite gradually and form a white dwarf star. And a white dwarf, the structure of the atoms is crushed, and the density becomes about 1,000,000 times greater than the density of ordinary matter. Second possibility is that you have a star of intermediate mass. Such a star will collapse quite violently. It will produce a tremendous outburst of luminosity, which astronomers refer to as a supernova. For a few months, the object will become as bright as the entire galaxy in which it appears. In other words, for a few months, this object will radiate with a luminosity of perhaps 1,000,000,000 suns, and then it gradually fades away, and what is left then in the center is pulsar. Finally, in the case of extremely massive objects, nothing can stop the collapse, and the object essentially crushes itself out of existence. And what you're left with then is what astronomers refer to as a black hole. The object becomes so concentrated that no photons, no light particles can leave its surface. So that even though these objects can still influence the rest of the universe through their gravitational mass, it's completely impossible ever to see them.
Now, one of the pulsars has been identified optically in the beautiful nebula that you photographed, the Crab Nebula. You know, when I first studied astronomy, the picture of the Crab Nebula was shown to me as an object which we didn't quite understand. It wasn't like anything else in the galaxy. And then in another 10 years or so, Mount Wilson measures showed that this was expanding outward from a central point. And a few years later, a search of Chinese records showed that there had been an outburst of a star in 1054. A.D., the Chinese recorded a guest star. And I understand that some of the archaeologists in the Southwest think they have a pictograph in an Indian cave on July 4th, 1054, for that outburst.
Yes, it turns out that on the morning of the 4th of July of the year 1054, the moon was, in fact, very close to the position at which the supernova outburst occurred, so that if one were to look up at the sky, one would see the supernova very close to one of the horns of the moon. And this, of course, was a very impressive sight, and apparently some of the Indians in the southwestern United States made drawings of this on cave walls.
And it would be brighter than any star in the sky and probably than the planet Venus at that time.
Yes, in fact it was so bright that for a number of weeks this object was visible during the daytime.
And the material that we see now is what has been cast off from that great outburst, moving outward with what velocity?
With the velocity of about 1,000 miles per second. Actually, what we see, the optical remnant of the Crab Nebula, which you see in the picture, consists of two components. In the first place, you see what looks like a set of filaments. This, in fact, represents material that was originally in the supernova, in the star, that's been blown away. The other, more amorphous-looking nebulosity that you see in this picture is due to particles that are still being ejected from the central star, from the pulsar, that are spiraling in the magnetic fields that are present in this nebula and emitting radiation in the process. The pulsar itself is the little star which you see in the nebula there. It's exactly similar to the other star just above it, to the eye, but it's not till you take high time resolution observations that you see that this one star, the pulsar, in fact, does not shine at a steady rate, but is pulsing 30 times a second.
And is this still the only optical identification of a pulsar?
Yes, a number of other radio pulsars have been studied optically, but in no case has optical radiation been observed.
But there are many, or there are quite a number of other supernovae remnants in the sky.
Yes, a very large number of remnants is known, although there are only three remnants that we've observed that are younger than the Crab Nebula. There is the remnant of Kepler's supernova, which exploded in the year 1604, the remnant of Tycho's supernova, which was observed in the year 1572, and finally there is the remnant of the supernova of the year 1667, which unfortunately was not observed at the time because this object exploded behind a vast interstellar cloud of dust which dimmed its radiation considerably. Nevertheless, we can observe this object at the present time as a radio source. In fact, it's the strongest radio source in the sky. Also, with large telescopes like the 200-inch telescope, one can photograph the remnant of this object.
It's called Cass-A.
Cassiopeia-A, meaning that it's the brightest source,
radio source,
in Cassiopeia.
And isn't it the brightest one in the whole sky?
That is correct. In fact, mm-hmm. It's the brightest radio source in the whole galaxy. If you look at the picture, you will see how the structure of the remnant has changed during the last 10 or 20 years. You can actually see how the remnant is moving, is expanding away from the center of the object, which is marked by a little cross. You'll also notice that whereas in the Crab Nebula there was a pulsar in the center, in this object, in Cassiopeia A, there's nothing at all visible in the center of the remnant, and perhaps there is a black hole there which nobody can see.
And there are older supernova explosions recognized in the galaxy?
Oh yes, there are many older remnants. Perhaps the best example is the Veil Nebula. The Veil Nebula is a very large supernova remnant that is thought to be about 40,000 years old.
And there was quite a stir recently about the Gum Nebula for the pulsar in Vela. And the old fossil Stromgren sphere around it?
Yes. This is an observation which is still being considered by a lot of astronomers and is really a little bit preliminary. Just
I see.
Moment.
You don't entirely go along with the findings, or you wait to see further confirmation.
Well, I think that we just have to wait to see what the further observations show, particularly observations in X-ray and infrared wavelengths, which are being made.
But this was something that happened about 11 or 12,000 years ago, presumably, that this sphere of material was...
Yes, the idea is this, that a supernova, when it explodes, not only emits visible light, but it also emits ultraviolet radiation and vast quantities of X-rays, and this radiation is able to ionize the interstellar gas clouds in its vicinity. In other words, the hydrogen atoms are split, and you get protons here, electrons here. These are separated, and after a number of years, hundreds, thousands of years, electrons find back protons. As they fall back into these into orbits around these protons, form new atoms again. They emit radiation, and this radiation is visible. And in particular, it's thought that a very large galactic nebula, the so-called Gum Nebula, is due to radiation of this sort. Now, this particular hypothesis is necessary because it turns out that there is no star presently bright enough to account for the radiation that we observe coming from the Gum Nebula, so we have to go back and assume that the Gum Nebula was ionized by a flash of radiation that occurred about 14,000 years ago.
I understand that a supernova can give off in one day as much radiation as our sun gives off in 1.5 million years. Those figures?
Yes.
Right?
That sounds about right.
And you found a new supernova recently in another galaxy. They occur in other galaxies beside our own.
Yes, in an average galaxy, one gets about one supernova per 100 years.